Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurick, Jacob Kanzler, Mike Malott, and Jack Spencer. A little later, Wendy Block from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce will be joining us to talk a little bit more about lame duck and some of the initiatives they're pushing, which have become a little on the controversial side, as is most of lame duck, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. But first, guys, I want to talk about a story that we did a couple weeks ago on redistricting and a question that I think a lot of folks have had since the 2018 election, and that is, could the Democrats had won either control of the Senate or the House under different districting maps? And I think we can agree that you can probably draw any district map that you want to get the results that you want to. But if you're following the APOL standards, could you have drawn districts that the Democrats could have won in for the state Senate and the state House? And we talked with Ed Zarpolis, who has done maps for the city of Chicago, and he also did maps for us back in 2011, John, when we took a look at what redistricting could look like. And we also talked with Brian Began, who made, in part, the maps that we all live with right now. And they both agreed that the answer is no, John.
Well, and part of it is interesting, too, because it comes down to sort of where the Democrats are concentrating, where the Republicans are concentrating. And then you have to throw in the concept of what's a community of interest and what can you divide and what you can't divide. If you really want to create more purple districts, then you have to divide those concentrated urban districts that are heavily Democratic, like the city of Detroit. Well, then you start running afoul of issues like the Voter Rights Act, where you cannot dilute minority-majority districts. So it's not that easy, as people would like us to believe it is.
So we took a look at the maps, and for the state Senate, we'll start there. We did find one district that maybe you could change around, the 10th district in Macomb County. You could put in Mount Clemens and maybe take out some other areas, and maybe you could have made that more Democratic, and the Democrats possibly could have won that. So we'll give that to them, and then that will be the 17th. But after you get past that, it gets really hard, because if you're following the APOL standards, which are fewest municipal and fewest city line breaks as humanly possible, it's hard to do. You could take a look at the 24th district that Tom Barrett won, and maybe you can try and find a way to cut some of Lansing. But again, now you're cutting the city of Lansing, and that violates one of the tenets of the APOL standards, which is fewest line breaks. I remember back in 2011, guys, when the legislature was crafting these lines, and the Republicans put their maps on the table, and they challenged the Democrats to come up with maps that had fewer line breaks than they did, and they didn't do it. I don't remember a map coming back that had fewer line breaks. And so, Jacob, that gets to the point then in the state house that unless you want to cut the city of Saginaw or the city of Kalamazoo or the city of Muskegon in half or in pieces, it's hard to make a Democratic district.
Yeah, and one of the challenges you'll see in Michigan and across the board, as John mentioned, is that we are seeing an almost predictable Republican rural Democrat urban split. And so you're having that issue creating the maps. When you look at the article and you kind of go through, the article kind of goes through the process of what could you do? And we've kind of discussed this already. And I think it could bring up a good public policy debate of what do we prioritize in making the districts? Do you want to kind of get a definition around this community of interest thing where you want to have, you know, a like group of people regardless of county and city line? Or is it more important to not break county and city line? And I think maybe that could be the discussion that we have. Maybe the Lansing region is more of a community of interest than making sure that Delta Township stays segregated from Lansing. So I think if anything, this could be a discussion that they'll have at the table for the redistricting commission in a couple of years.
You got some thoughts on this, Jack?
Well, is this what we're predicting? Are we kind of throwing out the idea here that maybe one of the first debates this new commission will have is whether or not they are tied to the APOL standards?
Exactly. Are the APOL standards what we should strive for or not?
And you know that that's a direct line, one of the several ones that will immediately go into court if they were to try to do it among probably several other ones that will end up being in court if they challenge it or they say, no, we're not going to do it. I just don't think this is going to be an automatic, we're going to draw this thing and we're going to really take this thing over. I think everybody knows there's going to be a lot of court action coming off of this thing.
So we'll see what the new redistricting commission does in regards to how they craft the maps and whether we're going to have more municipal line splits or we're going to have keep the APOL standards together as much as humanly possible. And with the Civil Rights Act, I'm just curious how much more different this is going to look. Look, you go past Clare, and the Republicans won everything except for the city of Marquette. The only district they really came close in was Grand Traverse County. And you can't make a district any different than the Grand Traverse County district. It is itself just that county, and that's the district. And the Democrats came close, but you can't draw that district any different without going over into maybe Benzie or something and cutting the county in half, and there's a municipal line break right there. So anything north of Clare is almost off the table, and that's where the Republicans are going to win. So after that, then what do? There are no Democratic clusters that you can put together to get yourself a district outside of the city of Marquette. The Upper Peninsula is practically off the table for the Democrats for the next cycle and maybe the cycle after that, as long as Trump is on the ticket. But anyway, okay, so we're going to move on now. We're going to talk more about the lame duck because, boy, John, lame duck ended the first week with a significant bang. These bills that got dropped with changing the powers of the Secretary of State, giving the legislature more authority in legal proceedings involving bills. Woo, this could be a big lame duck.
You got to remember every lame duck, at least every lame duck I can think about. We spend the first week sort of inflating this inflatable duck into a huge, enormous size. And then the last two or three weeks of the lame duck session, we watch the air slowly leak out of it as it sinks beyond the surface of the pond. Whether any of this or all of it or part of it gets enacted, we'll know in a couple of weeks. But my guess is a lot of the controversial stuff that could be seen as one party favorites, are probably not going to get signed into law, probably not going to be seen at the end of the end of the lame duck.
Could this be that legislation like the creating of a new elections commission and taking power out of the Secretary of State to oversee campaign finance questions and dealings and so forth, that maybe this is a lot of flash to distract our attention away from maybe things that the Republican majority really wants to get done? Is that a possibility? I'm just going to put that out there because I have a hard time seeing Rick Snyder signing something like the creating of an election commission that is crafted 2 weeks before Christmas.
Well, that's a good question. I guess I would wonder, what are they trying to distract from?
I think that'd be giving the legislature as a whole way too much credit for the ability to. These are all different people that are want this and want that, and oh boy, it's Christmas time. We can throw in there anything we want, and it has a chance of becoming law. And plus, don't forget all of these bills and all of these ideas that these people are. The clock's running, ticking on that get thrown in the mix also. So no, my answer is no. I don't think it's distraction. I just think it's disorder.
Don't you think at the end of the day we're going to be talking about line five? We're going to be talking about a supplemental appropriation bill getting through. We're going to talk about his signing the minimum wage piece, and then his signing the earned sick leave piece,
and then him trying to get the tipping fees.
And the tipping fees, and that's going to be the. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the size of the lame duck when we're done.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think you see this with lame ducks is that with the time constraints and the pure volume of bills. I mean, you just mentioned the big ticket items that you can probably bet on are happening. And then you have all this, the volume of like pet projects that we write about, maybe we don't write about, that just need to get through for various reasons. I think the sheer volume of lame duck kind of choke out some of these things. And so we'll find out soon. It's kind of hard to tell at the initial that some of these more controversial things that maybe we don't see pass, are these pipe dreams of certain Republicans, or does it have enough caucus strength to make it a priority kind of thing?
You know, it's kind of like the excitement of a big game. You know, you get so excited and you got big dreams and big hopes. It was like, you know, I went to this MSU
before the Ohio State game.
Oh, right. Well, I was going to do this example. I took the kids to go see Michigan State soccer on Saturday. okay? And it was cold as hell out there. And I bundled up. I brought blankets. I had a tarp. And the first half, we were so excited to watch this game. And gosh, State was getting really close, and they were about to score. And then the cold drizzle came. And the clock was ticking. And by about halfway through the second half, I just wanted it to end. Like, I didn't even care if State won anymore. I just wanted it to end. And so then we just got up and left before State scored their two goals and won the game, right? So we never got to see it. So I bring this up because lame duck. It's like lame duck. Because you got to remember, these folks, after they've given all their goodbye speeches and everybody's given their hugs and they've poured their heart out, they look at the clock come December 22 and they're like, shoot.
Take their plate of cookies and their box from their office and they want to go home.
Remember to keep in line what the travel and flight schedules are of
exactly
and very important exactly. leaders, because those are hard deadlines if I've ever seen them.
My football analogy would be the Hail Mary, because for a lot of special interest groups, the lame duck, for whatever their issue is time for the Hail Mary. And so these issues get thrown out there too, and they also get a lot of PR as if there's maybe more realistic for them to get it than it really is. And as far as the drizzle goes, yes, the drizzle comes in and it kills all of this kind of stuff. But the point is, these groups know one or two of them may get there.
Right, exactly.
And so they're all pressing very hard because, oh my gosh, we're going to have to redo our legislation and everything else next year if we don't get it now.
My favorite lame duck tale is a prominent lobbyist in town. I asked if he was excited about lame duck, and he said no. I said, why are you here? He said, to kill stray cats and dogs. All right. Well, with that, then, let's bring in Wendy. Join us now in MERS World Headquarters is Wendy Block. She is with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Wendy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It sounds like we're going to have an exciting day over at the Chamber today. We're going to have some protests over at the Chamber. Are you guys going to be giving them coffee and donuts or...
No, but we certainly respect the right to free speech. We understand that there are people that are not happy with our position on these two bills to improve the mandatory paid sick leave and minimum wage acts. And they certainly have a right to express their opinions, and we're going to let them do so peacefully on our property if they so choose.
So you mentioned the two ballot proposals that the legislature passed, and then they're going through the process of amending them right now. And obviously the first argument, and before we get into both of them, the technical details of them, their argument is the legislature approved them. Why should they be going back now and changing them? Isn't there a problem with doing that legally and, you know, maybe on principle?
So we think the Constitution is very clear in this regard. It gives the legislature a window after ballots have been deemed to have sufficient signatures to make the ballot. The legislature has a 40-day window where they can do a number of things. They can reject it outright, send it to the ballot to the voters. They can adopt it as is, which is what they chose to do. They can do nothing, which sent it to the voters, or they can put a competing proposal on the ballot. In this case, the legislature exercised their constitutional right to adopt and therefore preserved their ability to amend those laws at a future date. And that's what the legislature did here. And I don't think they hid anything. They basically said at that time that we, the legislature, are adopting both of these ballot proposals to preserve our right to take back control of policymaking.
So obviously, as we've seen the process play out here, these groups brought ballot proposals to the voters that got them signed, and now we're seeing the business community want to amend these with changes that, you know, you guys see are good. Obviously, now you're seeing this blowback where groups are saying you guys are messing with the will of the people. My question is, with some of these changes, some of these amendments, could this have been avoided if the Republican legislature had moved to adopt some of these practices before, and before any ballot proposal kind of surfaced on these issues?
I suppose, but there is some fundamental, just kind of core disagreement on these policies. And for the chamber, we believe these decisions should be made in the marketplace, in between employers and employees. The question of how much, you know, people should be paid and or what kind of leave time they should have. With this, we're here right now because 380,000 or so people signed a petition to try to put this issue on the ballot. I certainly wouldn't say it's the will of the people that the legislature is somehow working to circumvent, because it was really only 380,000 people who signed petitions. But, you know, I think now we're having this policy decision, and we got here because of the petition process. I think what the legislature is trying to do here is responsible. They're trying to find kind of a balance between giving people the right to a $12 minimum wage or mandatory paid sick leave, but to do it in a way that makes sense for Michigan. Both of these proposals are very extreme as written. They would put Michigan at a complete outlier from a national perspective. And the legislature is saying, okay, we understand people may want a $12 minimum wage and may want mandatory paid sick leave, but let's try to find that right balance here in terms of making the policy work for employers and employees alike. And I think that's what's getting lost in this debate, is how these proposals as written really could impact negatively the employees that it's trying to help.
Now, talking about the minimum wage, and we'll start with that one first. What the legislature has done now with this amendment is basically pushed off the $12 minimum wage till the year 2030. You could argue that you could do nothing with the minimum wage and leave it as it was before they even bothered collecting signatures, and they would have had a $12 minimum wage by 2030.
It probably would have been a little less than $12 by 2030. What this is doing is saying, okay, at $9.25, you know, we just went through this four-step increase in the minimum wage. The last increase of $9.25 went into effect this past January. We already have the highest minimum wage rate in the Midwest. We already have one of the highest minimum wage rates in the nation. And going to $12 an hour over four steps is just simply too high, too fast. And so what the legislature did here is decided kind of to take us to 12, but take it over a more gradual upcline, if you will. So, you know, again, I think it's just about trying to lessen the impact on employees, lessen the impact on employers, but still try to get to that number that proponents were shooting for.
One of the things I was curious about with the chamber, right? Obviously you're focused on the wage issue. Obviously you're focused on the earned sick leave issue. Are there any other issues that you really want to see accomplished?
The line five issue is a big priority for us as well in lame duck. We understand that the Senate has some concerns about the Mackinac Bridge Authority and, you know, giving it there. I think there's some amendments that are going on, talk about amendments to try to get there. But we really think shutting down line five is not a good policy for our state, for people who need propane in northern Michigan and the UP. But we definitely want to protect the Straits of Mackinac, protect Michigan's Great Lakes, and think that some of these proposals that are on the table are a good starting point, and hope to be involved in those negotiations here as lame duck continues.
I got a question jumping back to the minimum wage and the sick leave. I think people understand the philosophical arguments about that it actually hurts the people who are looking for jobs, the people who are working in that market and trying to, some of them may be losing jobs or some of them may be losing hours. But what I've always wondered is why isn't there ever data, or maybe I'm missing it, showing in this state or this area, these are the businesses that closed, these are the lower number of jobs, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like that's, it's always anecdotal, but are there any actual studies and examples that show the negative effect?
That's a good question. And I think a lot of times it's hard to kind of pinpoint an actual reason for those job losses related to these public policies, but certainly it's that maybe that last thing that kind of made them go under. When we look at minimum wage, you can look at the tipped employees and the example there of completely eliminating the tip credit, so going to 100% of the minimum wage, and the impact in Seattle, in San Francisco, in other local units of government where they've done this, the impact it's actually had on tipped employees and their take-home pay. In those municipalities, the tipped employees are actually advocating for bring back the tip minimum wage because their take-home pay has been less since those proposals have been adopted. So there's a good example there. There's lots of studies out there kind of about that. On mandatory paid sick leave, I think there's not as concrete studies in this regard. But certainly we know anecdotally, I mean, this is an issue that we've heard more from our members on than probably any other issue I've heard from members on over my 15-year tenure at the chamber.
The paid sick leave?
Paid sick leave. Just because it's impractical. Allowing employees to use paid sick leave leave in as little as 6-minute increments. The minute someone uses their paid sick leave, they have a rebuttable presumption if the employer disciplines or discharges that employee for any reason that it was because they exercised their right to paid sick leave. The 72 hours is an outlier. California has 24 hours of mandatory paid sick leave. 72 in the proposal, the ballot proposal. Now we're moving to 36, which is definitely more in line with other states. So the call-in procedures, the fact that if you want to have an employee give a doctor's note because maybe they've been abusing your system, you have to pay all out-of-pocket costs associated with that visit. And then at the end of the day, all that note can say is that the employee needed sick time. So it's just not reasonable how it's constructed. And that's what we're trying to just kind of put some parameters back in, like other states have done and like employers' common and customary practices do today.
Another question I have, because I've actually wondered about this kind of thing. This got interrupted. They got taken by the legislature, so they weren't on the ballot. And I've always wondered if that's a good move, because it would seem to me that if you know it's going to go on the ballot and you just decide that ahead of time in the spring, wouldn't these employers have the ability at that level to be telling their employees, if this passes, X, Y, and Z that you're not going to like is going to happen? And should it be automatically assumed that all those people are going to vote yes?
You know, that's a good point. This polls, both of these issues poll extremely well. They poll, you know, just based on the high-level talking points. We've seen polls that show as much as 80% voter support for this. The legislature decided to take action in this, so there really was no campaign, if you will. And that was kind of the next step, had the legislature not adopted, is for our members to kind of go back and educate their employees on the decisions that would need to be made had these things made the ballot, and try to do some ballot education. Neither of these issues have been defeated at the ballot box in any state, but that's not for a lack of trying on the business community's part, and also educating their employees. There's been some work done on that in other states, but just hasn't been enough to tilt it the other way.
I had another question on the minimum wage proposal. One thing that was discussed in committee in the legislation that the Senate is moving forward, they did not hook any future increases in the minimum wage, the CPI. We heard the explanation from Senator Hildenbrand, but I wanted to maybe understand where you guys are on that, and maybe some more on why that approach was not taken this time.
I think with the elimination of the CPI, so that's kind of putting increases on autopilot, if you will, we found that isn't successful in terms of kind of taking these issues off the ballot. Every 4 years, we're back with a new ballot proposal to go up, 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 up. And so rather than pretending that CPI is somehow going to do that, it kind of actually gives proponents the ability to make their case to the voters why you need another large increase. So we think it's not responsible to put these issues on autopilot. We think these decisions should be in the hands of lawmakers or voters. It didn't seem to kind of really do anything this last time around. It seems like a failed experiment. So I would say that was kind of the rationale there.
You mentioned the paid sick leave proposal as being the one issue that you've gotten more feedback from your members than any other in your time at the chamber. As you look through the paid sick leave ballot proposal, how many points of it did you flag as being a problem?
That's a good question. I'd say probably 10 to 15 high level issues that we found in terms of
10 to 15 high level. Mm-hmm. What about low level?
Oh, there's lots of little nitpicky stuff. Because this wasn't drafted by anyone with any connection to the workplace who understands common HR procedures and practices. We have members go through this and they say, but this, but this, but this. So it's just one of those issues where it just doesn't seem to have been drafted with any sense of reality about what actually these kinds of policies look like in the workplace. That's really the big concern here, is just it's not workable as drafted.
So what if the paid sick leave people, as they go through and put in paperwork to get in another ballot proposal for 2020. What if they come to the chamber and maybe work out a compromise? Is there a compromise to be had here? Are you guys willing to negotiate on something that's maybe workable for all sides, so we don't keep having this tennis match back and forth?
First of all, we think the Senate language has it right, that they got it right. They basically brought it back to reality. They brought it back to being in line with other states. But on this question of them filing petitions now again for 2020, I think they're proving that this isn't really about the policy. It's all about elections and campaigns and fundraising opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, it just seems to me that
this is about politics.
If they wanted, shocker, I know. You know, if they really wanted to have a discussion, they would have come to us before they put in their petition language last time around and said, "You've seen the poll numbers. We've seen the poll numbers. We know this thing could march itself to victory. Let's sit down and work out something that maybe would go to the voters or go to the legislature." It just seems to me if it's about getting the policy right, they would take a hard look at what the Senate does and a hard look at what other states have done and said, you know, this is pretty reasonable. The legislature isn't gutting this. The legislature actually tried to find this balance point, and it looks a lot like what we supported in other states, meaning they supported in other states. Mm. You know,
so you take umbrage at this characterization that what the legislature did is gutting both of these proposals.
We do. We think that what the legislature is doing here is pragmatic, that what they were trying to do was extreme, and they're trying to bring it back to kind of some center point, some sort of balance.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Wendy Block from the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for coming over.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Wendy Block for showing up today, and Jacob and Jack, John and Mike. And Jacob, I think you've got a new career that you may be interested in after journalism is all said and done.
I was worried where you were going with that, Kyle. I thought you were kicking out. But I read a fantastic article last week, or a couple weeks ago, in the lead up to Black Friday about professional line sitters. The headline is, professional line sitters make up to $35 an hour, and this is their busiest time of year.
Boy, that's more than collecting signatures.
Yeah.
No, if you think about it.
How much was it per signature? Is what the going rate, like three?
Yeah, I think it was $3 or $4 an hour, or $4 per signature. But shoot, you can stand in line for $35 an hour. That's even a lot more industrious than holding the signs on the corners for those businesses going out of business.
Very, very interesting. This might hit close to home. I understand our court reporter, Lisa, has been paying in her time to get in line to go to these hearings in Flint, which have been very well attended.
Yeah, so this is how she's able to get to Nick Lyon and so forth. It sounds like, Lisa, maybe we should budget for a professional line sitter for you.
Well, I'd be happy for that, because then I don't have to wait in court 2 hours for a hearing to start.
Yeah, Lisa's showing up at 8 a.m. for 10 a.m. hearings. I mean, we don't need to do that for even the most contentious committee hearings.
No, I usually show up 5 minutes late and get there just fine.
If I show up early, I don't get a seat.
Well, no, I understand. That's what I'm saying.
But
that's great, though. See, you've already got experience on line sitting, so maybe this is another career option for you, maybe down the line.
I don't have the patience. I couldn't do it.
Well, see, at least when you line sit now and for the Nick Lyon hearing, you can actually do some other work, right? Because you have a Wi-Fi signal.
Yeah, I spend those 2 hours going through email and working, actually writing other stories.
It's just your office is now in a courtroom.
It is, or the hallway.
What do you think these people do then for $35 an hour? What are they doing? How do they pass the time?
The article covers that a little bit. You know, they play on their phone, and sometimes they read a book or listen to music.
$35 an hour, Mike, to listen to music.
They're professionals. They say they're professionals, and yet they're reading on the job.
But are we really that lazy in society that you have to pay someone to stand in line?
Yes.
I think the answer is clearly yes.
If you've got the money, yes, you're that lazy.
Maybe we shouldn't have talked about this, because now they're going to want to have some regulations. Maybe this is a new thing that we're going to take up during lame duck. Regulations on line sitters and what happens if the person doesn't show up, or
we need consumer protections, Kyle.
Consumer protections.
Can we get the bill in before lame duck is?
Hey, they can still take hearings on first house bills, I think, this week. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.